Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Sean Owens. Sean is the founder of Granite Digital, an e-commerce agency based out of Ireland. And Sean has been a B2B e-commerce expert for over 20 years. He's got deep experience in this space. Had a fantastic conversation with him about where B2B e-commerce is today and where he sees it headed in the future. Enjoy. Welcome to B2B Commerce Corner. Commerce Corner is a sub-series of the E-commerce Edge podcast discussing all things B2B commerce through the lens of agencies, consultants, merchants, and more. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another amazing episode of the podcast. I have an incredible guest lined up for you today. I've got Sean Owens from Granite Digital. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you very much, Jason, for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate it.
My absolute pleasure to have you along for the ride today. And we were talking off air, particularly about B2B e-commerce and some of the, I guess, the changes you and I have both seen. We've been around the traps for a long time doing this e-commerce game. You've also got your own e-commerce consultancy in addition to the work that you do with Granite. And you're working primarily in Ireland, but also have clients across the UK and further afield than that. And we were just really chatting about what we've seen as a result, not only of COVID, but also just the natural maturation process that is happening in the B2B commerce space compared to the trajectory that retail e-commerce has been on for, say, a decade or more. And we were comparing notes how in the early days of retail e-commerce, a lot of these retail players were pure play e-commerce players in the retail space. They didn't want anyone to know they were doing e-commerce. They were killing it. They were making an absolute killing. The people that were paying 5 cents a click for Google ads, and they were doing being massively successful organically, et cetera. And they were very happy to sail underneath the commerce radar and scoop up all this almost free business. And it feels like a lot of the B2B players are acting and behaving in a similar way now, where there's a lot of B2B businesses making an absolute killing, whether it be in EDI, punch out, self-service, traditional e-commerce. There's a lot of businesses moving a lot of volume, selling a lot of product, and they're happy to just sit behind the scenes, have all the legacy B2B players not doing e-commerce at all. They're scooping up massive wins. They're scooping up market share. And a lot of people don't even know that they offer e-commerce or that they even exist. And they are very happy to keep it that way, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. We come across players that are, their front end of their website is, they don't show any product. It's a trade login. And on the trade login, then you see all the product. And they're also doing a lot more. They're doing a lot more than just simply offering e-commerce to their customers through their B2B sites. Like, they're showing invoices, they're showing statements, they're showing financial records to their customers. They're showing legacy pricing. They're showing all of this kind of stuff. They're showing, we've got e-commerce guys who are showing, they're showing their purchase orders coming through. So we've one guy selling furniture online, and his stores can come in and see when the delivery of the furniture is actually arriving. That there's a delivery coming in March. There's another one coming in April. I've got two more sofas coming in, whenever it is. And they can answer the customer straight away on the shop floor and say to them, yeah, we know when this stuff is coming in. And for that's B2B really operating at really serving the customer's customer, because he doesn't have to go ringing, or he or she doesn't have to go ringing up his wholesaler going, oh, when will we have those sofas? What's the lead time? All this kind of stuff. It's all there. And the incredible part about it is it's automated. He or she doesn't have to put in that information. It's all just pulled out of their accounting system. And any accounting system kind of worth its salt that's worked correctly. And that's actually another bugbear of mine, actually, is there's very few people running accounting software who actually know how to run it properly in its entirety. Most people just, they blow the lights out by going, oh, I can create an invoice. This is great. I know how to use my accounting software. But they forget there's a whole purchase order. There's a whole inventory management, the stock management. You can make it fire off orders to your suppliers when your stock levels go so low, et cetera, et cetera. And then once you're doing that, you then know what are my delivery time scales. And if I can give my delivery time scales, then I can show my customers when the lead time is on it. We have one particular client, and they're taking a feed in from Honeywell Automation in the Netherlands of all their product, all their stock, all the specs, and they take that feed in every single day. And specifiers are coming on building assembly lines. They're feeding in from their assembly line software. They can actually feed in a bill of materials into the B2B website. It comes out with a pricing for all the particular items they have, including the lead time. So they can actually then go to the factory and say to them, I will have this particular assembly line. Yes, I can deliver this to you on a particular date, knowing that this is when the last piece of whatever it is, cog or a conveyor belt, is coming into stock that they need, or a solenoid or whatever they're waiting on is coming in. So it's absolutely, as you said at the start, there's a lot of people knocking B2B out of the park, and they're staying damn quiet about it. They're keeping it as a secret. And I have clients coming to me now going, or new clients coming, going, we're just after hearing that this other guy is doing it down the road and you're doing it for him. What can you do? And I just say, this is the offering. I'm not telling you what we're doing down the road, but this is the offering that we give. So a lot of the time it's you're going in, you're having to look at all the client systems. It's not just delivering an e-commerce site like you would with a retail site. It's you're looking at their whole systems, because the more automation you can get into this, the better. And it makes their life easier. It means they're not answering silly questions from people looking for reprints of invoices, all this kind of crazy stuff that goes on. And they can spend more time sourcing product, refining stuff, making the whole operation run a lot smoother. Even something as simple as sales reps out in the market, out in the field, like B2B e-commerce that's linked up with the sales reps' iPads, where they're taking the order either out in the field with the customer, or they're doing it over the telephone remotely. But the minute that order goes in, it goes in. It's not waiting for some guy to arrive back home after being out on the road all day and then start tapping his orders in. And I know it sounds antiquated that should happen, but it still happens in a lot of places. Now, it's becoming a bit of a dying art, but it is happening. But 9 times out of 10, what's actually happening is a sales rep is arriving into a client. He's taking the order with an iPad, and the client is looking over the shoulder and going, what are you doing there? Can I do that? And he says, yeah, actually, you can do that. And then the sales rep goes, he literally then trains in his customer how to do this. And then he just moves on to the next guy. All the while, this customer is now ordering in product and they're self-serving themselves. So sales reps are not just going, they're going in getting new business. That's the way B2B people need to start thinking about this, that your sales rep is out there to get new business, constantly get new business. Set up those businesses and let them start ordering, and then let just themselves serve themselves thereafter, and just move on to the next and the next. But we would see, yeah, like anybody we've put in e-commerce, our B2B e-commerce for, has had the return on investment within the first 3 months, maybe the first 2 months, because of the average transaction value that's going through. So when you see the average transaction values of maybe 2,000, 3,000 euro, like within 2 or 3 months, this thing has paid for itself. It's astounding, really, that it would pay for itself that quick, because retail e-commerce would take a lot longer to pay for itself with a lot more effort in terms of marketing. When you consider most of these B2B customers, their customers are crying out for this. They're waiting for it. They're absolutely crying out for it. And if they don't have it, their competition is knocking on the door and making their life easy for them. Yeah, but it is exciting times. I find it curious, because I've been selling B2B e-commerce for probably about 10 years at this stage. And again, I feel like it's at the very early days of e-commerce. You're going into guys going, this is the way B2B e-commerce goes. And they go, oh no, I'm not selling to the public. And we go, no, we know you're not selling to the public. This is just about selling to your customers. And you might only be selling to 200 guys, but you still need a website. Just to sell to 200, you still need it. And they seem to think that, It's just a mindset thing. But once they get their head around it and they see it working and to see the sales coming through, and then it just becomes a small little money machine. Yeah, they're just onto it. Yeah.
Man, there's so much to unpick in that, but it mirrors what you've just said, mirrors so much of what I'm seeing in the market. But I'd love to also validate another thing that I'm seeing pretty routinely, which is that when I go into a lot of these B2B businesses and they're looking at setting up true, genuine self-service e-commerce for the very first time, they think that, okay, we run Xero, we run QuickBooks, we run the simple accounting system in the back end, but everything else we do with our customers via spreadsheet It's via Google Sheet. It's via Excel Sheet. It's via Carrier Pigeon. It's via fax. It's via all these other channels that they solicit orders through, or maybe it's literally on an order pad when they're in the field, literally a paper order pad. Okay, I'm writing down this. Maybe they even have a paper. I'm still seeing this in the market. They've got a printed catalog, which they release once per quarter with updated products, updated prices, et cetera. Okay, here's your tiered pricing. It's in the catalog. And then when they do the field sales call, they're literally writing down SKUs. They're writing down what the customer wants and then taking it back and they're keying it into their system. And oftentimes, they don't have anything really that automated. They might literally hand off that sheet of paper. They might enter it in as a PO into some kind of maybe a QuickBooks. Then they'll print that out. They'll literally hand it off manually to their warehouse for pick, pack, and dispatch processes. I'm seeing, whilst a lot of B2B businesses are figuring this out, there's still plenty that run their entire business out of spreadsheets. And so sometimes when I'm brought in and they think, oh, we're ready to do this e-commerce thing, our customers are asking for it, ready to set up a website and start selling, it's, hang on a second, we now need to look under the bonnet of all these manual processes. And we need to say, first of all, is the technology, the underlying back office technology ready for this? Is your data ready for this? Are you ready with the cohort of data that is ready to be presented to a customer through digital channels with images, with their customer-specific pricing, with the customer-specific subcatalog that are available to them? Is all this stuff ready to go from a data perspective? And also from a customer data perspective, do we have that ready to go? So it's not only product data, it's also customer data. Where are we going to get it from? How are we going to get it into digital channels? How are we going to present it to the customer? How are we going to enforce things like MOQs? How are we going to enforce things like buying increments? How are we going to enforce all these things that credit stop limits? How are we going to enforce all these things that you currently do manually? How are we going to transition that to digital equivalents? And oftentimes, when I'm brought in for maybe a pure e-commerce project, we now need to start looking at back office systems, processes, and data before we can even start thinking about the front end experience of the customer.
Oh, absolutely, Jason. You can't just go in and decide to do B2B e-commerce, take the same approach as you do with retail e-commerce, because you're absolutely right. You have to have a look at all of their systems. And the kind of heartbreaking part about it is they ring you up and they're all excited to go for it. We're going to go. They've made this board decision to go with B2B e-commerce. They've taken the plunge. They've basically said, yeah, this is it. And some guy's been assigned the job. And you go in and the first thing you start to do is you start to pick through their data. And one of my first questions to guys is, I'd say, what does your stock control look like? And they go, yeah, is it accurate? And they go, yeah, it's pretty accurate. And you go, do you have any minus items in your stock control? And they go, yep. And do you have any halves and quarters in your stock control? And they go, yep. And you go, I hate to break it to you guys, your stock control, it's either 100% right or 100% wrong. And you need to sort out your stock. You need to start doing an accurate stock take. This is where we need to start with. And we need to start unpicking that stock. And a lot of the times we've started projects and halfway through it, they've discovered, oh, there's a problem with the stock. It's not accurate, and something needs to be corrected before they can go further along with the process. But it's good because the whole process means that they're cleaning up, they're cleaning their data as they go. And by the time they come out the far end of it, they've got a really clean set of data. And with a clean set of data, then you can actually start making meaningful business decisions, because you do know that when you look at your website and 112 of this particular item in stock, you can hand in heart say, yes, there is 112 as of the last hour in stock of this item, and I can fulfill it if you come in to buy it. The other thing we've seen is we've even used it for credit control. So we would have some customers who would be on credit, and then there are other customers who turn out to be sticky payers, and they're put on credit cards. So they become MasterCard and Visa's problem, but they're still selling the product to them, and they still have this relationship with them. So they're not breaking the trading relationship with the customer because they're a sticky payer. They just make their credit issue become somebody else's issue. So it is quite interesting. But that kind of brings me around to the main, there is a kind of a cost of running B2B e-commerce. And because the margins are typically lower in B2B e-commerce than you get in retail, the interesting thing is that they're far more hyper aware of cost of ownership and cost of running the operation. And this is one of my little pet peeves, is the cost of credit card transactions. So if you're doing credit card transactions, in my view, are just ridiculously overpriced. You cannot tell me that it costs more processing power to process a 2 euro sale than a 200 euro sale. It's exactly the same processing power. It's exactly the same number of CPU cycles. Even if you've got to
or 2,000 or 200,000 exactly for that matter in the B2B world.
Exactly. So why is it a percentage? Why is it a percentage? It's been the first credit card company that comes to the market who decides it's not percentages, guys, it's bands. We're going to charge up to $200, we're going to charge $1 transaction fee. From $200 to $1,000, we're going to charge whatever. And then if it's 3D secured or whatever, we're going to charge fixed fees on our credit cards. Because this business of percentages, it's absolutely killing. Because if you think that these guys who are running B2B, they might be running at a 10% margin. Like a 10% margin, and then they're giving away 1% of that. They're giving away 1% of that on a credit card fee, which is, in the grand scheme of 100%, that's 10% on a credit card fee of your profit margin. This to me is a huge big obstacle. It's something that really needs to change, that we need to start getting. And I think there's some exciting stuff happening in open banking, and you're seeing it now where you've got peer-to-peer. You're now starting to see in open banking some peer-to-peer transactions that are bringing those online transaction fees down, making them quicker. In Europe, it's starting to get a little bit quicker, although it's still very slow. When you consider that the price of things changes an awful lot, and that's the other thing in B2B, the price of things change on a daily basis. It's not a pair of runners are $99 and they're going to be $99 for 8 weeks. That's not the way it works in B2B. I've got one particular customer and he sells stainless steel fittings. The price of stainless steel changes on a daily basis. He has to change his prices on a daily basis, and he has to change his future price of stainless steel on a daily basis. By the time it comes to actually delivering the product, the price is actually correct at product delivery time. There's a lot more moving parts inside B2B, but thank God it's all just software. So it's never wearing out. It's just more complexity, but once it's set up and it runs. And when it breaks, we always say it's the data. If it worked for 1,000 iterations and now it doesn't work, it's the data. There's something wrong with the data. But just transaction fees are just like everybody's looking for this small little sliver, slice of the pie or whatever. SaaS
Death by a thousand cuts.
They're looking for a small little sliver. Credit card companies looking for another sliver. And it just becomes very expensive doing business this way. And it's funny because I can see customers who started off on SaaS platforms now looking at the price of the SaaS platform where they're paying for the SaaS platform fee. And then all the add-ons they have, they're paying a monthly fee for all of those. And it's all kind of adding up. And now they're going, actually, if I was actually to do this in an own hosted platform, I don't actually need this size of platform to cope with. As I say, they're never going to have a Kardashian moment. So they're never going to get the Kardashians calling out a stainless steel fitting for a shower.
Fitting.
And next thing, all
on
the world
Instagram
wants to buy
and driving a million sales.
Yes. And that's what these SaaS platforms are absolutely fantastic for. They're brilliant. Those platforms stay up, and your only enemy is you running out of stock. But in the B2B, it's like your traffic is right down. It's now about automation. It's not about volume of visitors onto the website. It's all just about automation, making sure that automation works and making sure the cost of doing the transaction is as low as you possibly can get, because the margins are particularly low.
I 100% agree with you, and you raised so many good points. It's hard to even single out one for further discussion. But one area where I think B2B e-commerce needs to start realizing that they benefit versus a traditional retail e-commerce play is cost of customer acquisition. Because the reality is, yes, B2B merchants are always trying to find new customers, sure, just like retail e-commerce. But every time they acquire a customer, not only are the AOVs tend to be significantly higher than in retail e-commerce, but also customer lifetime value and stickiness tends to be significantly higher than in the retail e-commerce world. Whereas in the retail e-commerce world, sure, your margin might be better from a pure COGS perspective, but the reality is your cost of customer acquisition is sky high and going higher. So when we think about retained margins, the reality is that retail might look juicy and sweet, but I tell you, their cost of marketing departments, there's plenty of B2B businesses out there that don't even have a marketing department, don't even have a marketing team. Yep. They got a sales team, but they don't have a marketing team and they don't have a marketing department because they don't need it. And so the reality is that those retail margins, those gross margins might look juicy, but their net margins are absolutely brutal when you take into account their marketing costs and customer acquisition costs. Yep. And so I always try to help B2B brands to understand that their margins might look on the surface of it from a gross margin perspective, might look really rough. And trying to fit that into an e-commerce model looks even more challenging sometimes. But then when you start explaining to them all the other ways in which they save margin and they have a better net margin than a lot of retail brands, then it all starts to click for them. And then all of a sudden they're saying, if we can operationalize a whole lot of manual stuff that we do today, say, just take one tiny little sliver of operations for typical B2B businesses, the configure, price, quote phase, right? Oftentimes for these B2B businesses, the configure, price, quote phase is a manual process. It requires a field sales rep or at least an inside sales rep. And it might take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of their time to go through the configure, price, quote process, where if we can now all of a sudden make this a digital experience and a digital process where 80 to 90% of the heavy lifting is done digitally, now all of a sudden that is a huge cost center in the business that either goes away or largely goes away. And if you can help them see when you start to do discovery about all of their manual processes across the business today that you can either completely automate or at least largely automate, all of a sudden the light bulbs go on and they don't necessarily know what they don't even know. And they certainly don't know what is possible today with modern e-commerce and digital technology. And I'm sure you see this a lot too.
Yes, we do. I suppose like when a B2B website opens up, it's usually for an established business. So they're not starting from ground zero. They're not starting from zero customers. So they might have two or 300 customers. So we would see straight away, 10% of those customers are going to jump online straight away. There's no question about it. They've been waiting for this. 10% will go online. The next 10% will go on when they're given the nudge. And this is what we notice in Ireland, right? They will go on given the nudge. And then the next 30% then have to be actively encouraged to go online. But once they get going, they're never going back the other way. But the thing is, there's no cost of acquisition on these guys per se. It's only a matter of just educating those clients and customers. Because
it's a cost of conversion. It's a cost of converting them into an e-commerce customer, at least for replenishment ordering.
Yes. And so we would see, like we have one particular client and they're selling large capital equipment. So it's things like spectrometers, centrifuges, large capital pieces. And he said, we're not going to sell that online because each one of these requires advice, somebody to go out and spec it. It needs a scientist to look at it, whatever, and to make sure they're buying the right equipment. But he said, the nice thing about it is now we know that if this guy is buying a spectrometer or a centrifuge, he needs the consumables that go with this piece of equipment. And now
and the spares.
And the spares and everything. And he said, we have a complete, it's what retail e-commerce guy would give his eye tooth for this kind of setup. This is the kind of stuff that retail e-commerce owners dream about at night, to have somebody buy something and then to buy the consumables and have to get a monthly delivery of all the consumables from time immemorial, from time until they replace the machine with another machine and it needs more consumables. But the automation of that is absolutely key. It's all back to the automation again. But again, having those large, as I call them, POA, price and application products on the website that might be $100,000 or whatever they are, but unless the person knows exactly what they're after, but you're not going to get somebody pulling the credit card out for one of these, but they will come back for all the consumables. And then what we do is we will show the customer their invoices, whether they're online or offline invoices. But when they view that invoice online, we will put a buy now button on every single line of that invoice when they view it online. So the beauty of that is that you might go, oh, what did I order last month? And I pull up last month's invoice, have a look at it. I don't even need to go navigating around the website any longer. Now I'm just simply reordering off pressing buttons on an invoice. And it just makes their life so easy. And I don't know how many clients and customers have come back to me and they just said, this has just made our life so easy. I don't even have to remember what I ordered last month. I just pull up last month's invoice or last week's invoice, go through it and go, I'll have this. I won't have that. Oh, I need two more of that. I need one of that. Boom, done. And the order's gone in. And they're not even looking at product detail pages at that stage. They're just simply just going straight from invoice to cart, and that's it. So it's just about making their customers' lives easier, because they have enough to be doing tax returns and compliance and all the other sort of messy things they have to do.
Logistics and trying to
chase those retail customers. Online retail is a hard graft compared to B2B. B2B is a lot easier. If you're an established player in the market, as I say, whether you're selling pieces for robots or stainless steel fittings or whatever you're selling, yeah, it's a lot. Once you've got your established 200 or 300 customers or whatever number you need, it's a lot easier. Yeah, it's one of the best kept secrets, I would say. Yeah.
And you raise a very good point, which is that when B2B customers come to an e-commerce website to buy off of a supplier, they're not there to shop. They're not there to browse. They're there to buy, and they're there to buy as quickly as humanly possible to get them in the experience, get the products added to the cart, check out, and get out of the experience as fast as humanly possible, because they're doing this as part of their job. They're not doing this at home. Yeah. They're not sitting on the couch in front of the TV with their family, browsing their iPad at night, looking for the latest dress to drop or the latest cool t-shirt design to drop. They're as part of their job. It's part of their efficiency in their job. If they can buy off of their suppliers faster, it frees up time for them to do other parts of their job. And so it becomes really mission critical to them to have a frictionless buying experience. But I also agree, I think one of the other things that oftentimes gets forgotten about is that as part of making this as frictionless as possible for the B2B buyer, I'm starting to hear and I'm starting to see and I'm starting to get more requests about subscriptions, or what we would call subscriptions in the retail e-commerce world. Like for dog food, we're now starting to hear terms like auto ship, auto replenish, auto order. Those are the types of, it's the equivalent, it's the same type of experience, but we're using it in the B2B context. And so if that customer, like you said, is going back to their previous orders and they're saying, I want all these five things again, month after month, and I don't want to have to search for the SKU or anything like that. Now we can introduce a subscription-like experience for our B2B customers, for their consumable goods, for their items that they're going to order month in, month out on a regular basis. We're going to send them a message in advance of that order shipping just to make sure they still want that. They still want that amount. They have time to adjust before we actually fulfill. That has not only massive positive implications for the B2B buyer, but it also has massive implications and benefits for the B2B seller, because all of a sudden now they have a much more predictable buying stream. They know how much forward inventory they're going to need. They know how much off of maybe they're a distributor and they're buying off manufacturers. And in their ERP, they know the lead times for each of these manufacturers that they typically need. And now all of a sudden, they can get much closer to just-in-time ordering with their suppliers, because they know in advance with reasonable certainty what the demand is going to be like. And this leads me into a broader discussion, which is that personalization in the B2B world is much easier than it is in the B2C and D2C world. In the B2C and D2C world, we're using wisdom of the crowd knowledge to personalize the experience for even visitors from page one of a visit to our website. Whereas in the B2B world, we know who our customers are. We have deep, long-term relationships with them as a rule. And so therefore, personalizing their experience becomes significantly easier and significantly more beneficial to them than it is even in the B2C world. Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you. And now back to your listening.
Yes, it's interesting. I've heard your discussion about subscriptions in B2B, and it's subscriptions are usually fraught. They're probably the most difficult thing to actually implement are subscriptions. And there's times where clients will come to me looking for subscriptions and I'll say, we're actually on the wrong platform for subscriptions. I know the platform to use for subscriptions is one platform we all know begins with an S that works ridiculously well for subscriptions. And if you just switch your customer across to that platform, their subscriptions will just stick. They will stay and they will stick. And that's just the way it is. But yeah, it is interesting in B2B. I think that our concept of subscriptions is slightly different in B2B insofar as we need a constant supply of some consumable to do a particular machine. And probably the way B2B is probably going to handle subscriptions is probably doing forward purchasing with a concept of forward purchasing on products as opposed to thinking of it as a subscription. Like, and I know you're probably saying, sure, forward subscription is the same as a subscription, but it really isn't insofar as that we're saying we're going to need this volume of, we know from last year, this was the volume of consumables we needed for this machine going from month to month. And next year, we know that this is what the volume is going to be. So I might need a large quantity in January, February, March, maybe not so much in April and May, maybe very little in June. And then I need more, whatever the manufacturing process is and the peak and the trough, because there's peaks and troughs in every business. To me, that's more about, it's the forward buying opportunity and for customers to be able to go in and say, in a matrix, be able to say, yes, actually my forward ordering is going to be these, and to show what they want to order in the future. And then as time goes on, be able to adjust those numbers up and down slightly so as to meet. But again, it's still giving the beauty of allowing the B2B owner know an indicative amount of this product to order in, because that's in essence what you want to do in a subscription. You want to be able to plan forward, as you say, and know how much of this do I need to buy in, how much cash do I need to buy the product, et cetera, and how am I going to do my cash flow. So I always think of it as, I think it would be a forward purchasing plan kind of thing, as opposed to somebody's going to come up with a catchphrase for it. I don't know what it is, but rather than actual per se, because I always think of subscriptions as just like buying a subscription for coffee or whatever it is you buy, or a magazine. It's just every month, it's exactly the same thing until such stage as you stop it. But it doesn't presume that actually you're going to change this subscription ever so slightly every month, bring it up, bring it down, or maybe plan out 3 or 4 months in advance. And that's what people need to do. That's what people want to do. They want to be able to plan out in advance and then just do a kind of a set and forget on it and just go, okay, that's it, we're fine. Or if they find, actually, we find that machine actually isn't consuming as much of this particular item, or our demand for paper has reduced, or whatever, our packaging, because the way we're packaging, then to be able to reduce that, to use your term, the subscription, but my term, the forward purchasing, to be able to reduce that down while it's in flow. And that to me is like, but that's for the super organized. But once you're catering to the super organized, they're the ones who are going to survive. It's not the chaotic people who are going to survive. They're going to survive by good fortune, but it's super organized that will survive in business.
And I think also, again, going back to that level of personalization that we can do in the B2B world, we can actually tap in, the B2B seller can actually tap into the B2B buyer's ecosystem. For example, if they have an inventory system that we can integrate with, and then the B2B buyer says, okay, here's my min-max level of items of this particular SKU that I want to hold a certain amount of inventory of 100% of the time. Now we can actually pull down their inventory level into our system, and we can auto-generate orders for them. Yes. And charge it to their account based on their inventory holding and the numbers of inventory that they've told us that they want to keep in stock at all times. So there are, and this is just one example of the type of personalization we can do in the B2B world on a customer-to-customer basis that you cannot do in the retail world. And what do you think, given that level of personalization that we can do, given the amount of predictability of revenue that we can bring to our business, given the enhanced level of service that we can give to our B2B customers, if we so desire, why do you think that in certain, in particular, legacy verticals that B2B sellers have been so late to the e-commerce party versus, because we agree, most B2B businesses are perhaps, say, a decade behind their retail e-commerce peers. And what do you think has been the biggest contributor to them being what I would call digital laggards?
It's a really good question. I think a lot of industries, a lot of B2B sellers are in very legacy. Their business is legacy. It actually hasn't moved on a whole lot or it's headed up by, they're typically headed up by, I would look at builders merchants. So in Ireland, there's a thing called builders merchants. I don't know whether it's the same thing in New Zealand or around the world. It's basically a builder supplier. So if I'm going to build a house, I go to what's called a builders merchant. And that's where builders tend to go to buy as opposed to the general public. So they're not going to put up with the general public coming in going, what kind of guttering should I get for my house? They presume that the guy who's coming into the trade counter knows what a gutter is and he knows exactly what he's looking for. But those businesses tend to, and we would see this in Ireland, those businesses have been late in coming to e-commerce, and especially the B2B end of it, because a lot of them are still, they come from a traditional building background where they basically have just operated hand-to-mouth, day-to-day in their business. That's what they've come from. And some of them are now halfway, they're stuck with one foot in retail and one foot in what we call trade. And they're because it's the retail is so difficult, they're terrified now of the trade. They're terrified of putting the trade side of the website online. And I'm looking at them and I'm going, forget your retail side. The money's in the trade side. Just forget this side of it. And yet and all, they would have come to me looking for this retail side at the start. And I suppose they would be turning around going, why did you send me the retail one if the trade one was such a great idea now? And it does get a bit awkward, but you can see it, and I can see it, like the guys who go in and run this trade site. But again, why are they laggard? It's just, yeah, these guys, I bought a thermostat for my heater, for my central heating the other day. I bought it from a local supplier, and on the way out of the yard, the trade counter gave me a triplicate slip. And on the way out of the yard, a guy at the security hut checked what was in my boot, and took the other triplicate slip off me and went ahead. And I drove out and it was all paper. And this is now 2024 and this is triplicate paper printed on a dot matrix printer. You wouldn't believe it. And yet and all, it's still the way they're doing business. And they don't see that really what they should have had was one item printed off and it should have just been scanned in with an ordinary bog standard barcode scanner. And that would be it if they have to have the security check on the way out. So it's just they're just stuck in very traditional land. Like when I go in and I see into some clients and you see a dot matrix printer with stationery that's triplicate with the holes running up the edges of it, you say to yourself, oh my God, at least they're not handwriting this stuff. But it is. You look at it and they're running off a very legacy, maybe Unix system sitting in the background, because that comes as music to my ears, because that's the background that I come from. So when I see these legacy Unix systems sitting in there, I go, I know for a fact that the last two whiz kids who came in here looked at that system and ran a mile. And I come in and I look at that system and I go, give it to me. Yes, we can make this work. I can get a data feed out of this.
We can make an AX 400 work.
Yes, we can push the products and we can push the prices in and out of this system. We can automate it. We can make that triplicate form come out of that printer automate you. Yes, I can absolutely do it. When you come in the morning, you can just press a button and print off all your dockets that you need to do and fulfill them all. And we can then automate your shipping notes that need to go out to whatever shipping company and your bills and all of that kind of stuff. So that's, and once that's all automated, and I know I'm like a broken record talking about automation, but once that's all automated, they can get through a bigger volume of stuff. They're getting through it more accurately. The stock control is more accurate. They're checking stock in and out. There's less margin for human error in it. there's still probably the same amount of people doing the work, but it means then when they get really busy, it's not meltdown situation. They're still able to keep up with it when it gets really, really busy. So, and again, it's the cost of ownership. The cost of actually running it is relatively small when you consider what they would be just paying of credit card fees. The cost of running this stuff is pretty, pretty small. And most manufacturers now will come with good catalogs of images and descriptions and product data sheets and all of that kind of stuff. So it's not a case that you have to go out and rewrite all this stuff yourself and put it all in by hand. Most manufacturers worth their salt will have this stuff all sorted out in a PIM where you can just pull this stuff down on demand. Some of the more progressive ones will even have their stock holdings and their lead times on it. And so therefore, it's an absolute gift. And the manufacturers who have this sorted are way ahead. They're way ahead of everybody else in terms of, because they're just selling more product and they're selling it to B2B online guys who can just present the product in this way to their selected customers. And it just makes life easy. It really does. And people can see lead times and all that kind of stuff. They can plan, they can satisfy customers better. It just makes life easy. When you look at those guys who got those printed catalogs, the first thing I always think of with that printed catalog, I would say to clients is, and how long do you spend making that catalog? And they'll usually come back to you and say, oh, and actually, there's John down at the office. That's his job. That's all he does. He makes full-time. The spring one and he makes the autumn one. And he's a full-time guy on this. And you're going, and where does he get all the images from? Oh, he gets them from all the suppliers. And where does he get all the prices from? Oh, he has them, in spreadsheets. And where does he have all the descriptions? Oh, they're in spreadsheets too. And he's bringing this all in and merging it all in. And then he sends it off to the printer and the printing company does it. And what we've now done for clients is we're actually now printing PDF catalogs on demand from their B2B e-commerce sites. And we do that on demand for them with their customers specific pricing in it. So if I've agreed a price for one particular customer, I now can give them a specific PDF brochure. If they want the paper brochure, I can give them this PDF specific brochure complete with the QR codes in it for them to browse and print to their heart's content. And they can print it off today knowing it's 100% accurate. They can print it off tomorrow knowing it's 100% accurate with the price changes. And this is, again, another small piece of automation that just comes into play. And once it's set up, it's there. It's there to work forever. We do quite a few of our customers actually will opt for the auto-generated PDF catalog because there are, and they will just do a small, run of that catalog. But again, it just means that there isn't a John in the office whose whole thing is just to get the autumn catalog done and the spring catalog. And then everything in between is out of date. So it's just another example of the automation that can be added into it. It's just, I would say, any company's just not doing B2B e-commerce. You need to hear that large bell ringing in your head and just get onto it quickly. What we've done, just to give you a small case in point, there's a package in the UK and Ireland called Sage 50, and it's a huge accountancy package. You've probably heard of it. What we have done, it's exactly the same accountancy package everywhere it's installed. It's exactly the same. The data set is absolutely the same. So what we have done is we've actually developed a piece of software now that we can actually create a B2B e-commerce site within 1 hour using all your Sage 50 data. And that brings all your customers across, all their invoices, all their statements, all your prices, all your customer-specific pricing, and all your stock levels across. Within an hour, we can set that up for you because we know that Sage 50 is exactly the same installation that's everywhere. Your only downside, the only enemy is that your stock levels are incorrect in Sage 50, bringing us back to the half item or the quarter item or whatever. So once your data is clean in Sage 50, we can produce a B2B e-commerce website in that speed. And it's amazing. It's just when people see that and they go, oh my God, that's incredible. But again, we were being asked to do loads of integrations for Sage 50, and we decided, you know what, we're going to actually just standardize this. So we standardized it. So that's something we can run up within an hour. And for guys who are running Sage 50, it's within their budget. They don't have a huge amount of money to spend, but they do need the automation, and they do need to be able to compete with the bigger guys to actually stay alive and stay afloat.
And the other thing I'm seeing in the market, and I'd love your validation of this too, is that historically, a lot of B2B brands didn't have to do e-commerce. It just wasn't required of them because, especially if they were a distributor or a wholesaler, not so much a manufacturer, but as a distributor or a wholesaler, oftentimes they had a monopoly and they had a catchment that was assigned to them by a manufacturer. Okay, cool. You are our sole distributor for Ireland. You're our sole distributor for New Zealand. You're our sole distributor for the state of California or whatever it might be. And as a result of that, they had almost complete and total monopolistic power in their verticals, right? And now that is changing. That is changing very fast. And that's changing not only because the manufacturers are taking on more distributors because they realize that certain distributors have certain strengths and weaknesses. They have certain go-to-markets that differ. They have certain caches of customers that are unique to them that they couldn't get in front of without taking on more distributors or more wholesalers of their product. So it's changing from a manufacturer perspective and not granting such monopolist sole distribution rights anymore. But it's also because the distributors have gotten wise to this and they're setting up distribution basically almost like clandestine distribution operations outside of their allotted catchment. And they're going cross-border. They're selling into new markets, into new regions. And so manufacturers are now going direct to consumer, direct to be consumer here in many cases. And they're setting up in competition to their distributors. So the distributors don't necessarily have the world to themselves anymore. They don't have those monopolies anymore. And we also have a situation where the B2B sellers are aging out, meaning those traditional legacy B2B sellers are aging out. Also, the B2B buyers are aging out. And so therefore, the younger B2B sellers expect there to be an end-to-end digital experience to be available because they're digital natives themselves. And their B2B customers are now digital natives more and more. And as a result of that, they expect to be offered a digital experience. So to me, it feels like, particularly in the last 5 years, and particularly as a result of COVID, it has lit a fire underneath the B2B market, unlike anything I have ever seen before in my entire career. And we have a whole confluence of things coming together to make sure and demand that B2B sellers have some form of self-service e-commerce capability in their business. And a lot of that is just monopolies going away, people aging out, new digital natives coming in, and really having that as a base expectation that this is available.
Yeah, and what you get, another thing that you get a lot of, Jason, is you get a lot of acquiring distribution networks acquiring each other. So they acquire each other, but they continue with the digital asset. So they don't kill off the digital assets. They keep the digital assets running, but they're acquiring. And we can actually see it that there are businesses that have got better digital assets now are becoming more valuable for acquisition than businesses that don't. And we've seen this with a number of our customers who got acquired, that the ones who have the better digital assets have probably been acquired quicker than the ones with little or no digital asset. It is interesting. Actually, even from sector to sector, in Ireland, we would have it's an unwritten rule that the wholesaler never sells to the public. If the wholesaler sells to the public, in Ireland, it's omerta. You just don't even attempt it. Whereas in the UK, that's actually okay. It's not as big a deal in the UK. But the other thing that we have here in Ireland is because Ireland is still in the UK, still in the EU, and the UK is not in the EU, we have a huge issue now with the importation of goods. So there's a huge boom in e-commerce fulfillment warehouses in Ireland, and they're for Europe, basically. You will have sort of US brands coming in. They don't know how to get product into Europe. Traditionally, they would have brought it into the UK because it was English speaking, and they would have said, let's get it into the UK and we get it into Europe. But you can't do that now because without a whole extra piece of paperwork. But likewise, there's a huge amount of business that's done in Ireland with the UK traditionally because we're neighbours. And you will find that we have actually quite a lot of Irish firms now have set up UK subsidiaries to have siloed stock, to have siloed e-commerce sitting in the UK because the UK market is literally 25 times the size of the Irish market. So we would joke in Ireland that you're talking about the Irish market. Oh, you're talking about Manchester and Birmingham put together. That's what you're talking about. Would you build a website for just Manchester and Birmingham? I think not. So why aren't you thinking about going into the UK market? And then for us, then we look at the, like large markets like France and Germany. where it's only a translation. It's only translation services we have to bring in to play for markets like France and Germany. Because they're within the EU, we can just go straight into them. And it is interesting because even from an e-commerce point of view, Irish e-commerce web e-commerce warehouses will traditionally, they will service smaller clients. So you don't need 1,000 stock movements a day to get into an Irish e-commerce website or into an Irish e-commerce fulfillment warehouse. Whereas if I go to Germany, I might need a minimum of 1,000 stock movements per day. They just don't want to talk to me if I've got less than that. And whereas in Ireland, we get a lot less. So it is quite interesting because it has become a kind of a center for quite a lot of startup emerging products coming into Europe, and where the market, they haven't got a big enough foothold. They don't have the money to spend on a huge e-commerce outlay in an e-commerce warehouse, say in Germany. So it is quite interesting. And then we have the fudge of getting the products from the north of Ireland to the south of Ireland and vice versa across a borderless, a frictionless border. It is quite unique. Our e-commerce situation in Ireland is very unique because we like to brag that we're the only English-speaking country in the EU, which isn't really 100% true, but it is on a it is in the broader term. And it is quite interesting because it does pose quite a unique opportunity for us as well, because we're in the middle of the seesaw, because we're able to help people into Europe, we're able to help people out of Europe and into the US market. So it does really open doors on both sides. And particularly then again, when you bring that into B2B, niche manufacturers of items or whatever they're manufacturing, or even just wholesale distributors. But you're absolutely right. Wholesale distribution, this kind of thing of guys having an agency for a country, it's gone. It's impossible to police. You can't police it anymore anyway. And a lot of those traditional distributors, they would be the laggards. These guys who have the agency for whatever it is in our, and I know from, I'm a third generation or fourth generation retailer. My folks were in retail. I remember there used to be always these guys that would come into us, they were sales reps, and they would be the agent for Swiss Army knives, or the agent for Samsonite luggage, or the agent, and nobody else was allowed to sell it in the country. And I remember even in my younger days looking at this, thinking, this is what a charmed life to live. You know, that you were the sole agent.
It's a racket. It felt like a racket.
For Samsonite luggage in Ireland, and that's it. And nobody else can sell it. And there's absolutely no pressure on you to perform here at all. You can be as lazy as you like about this. Now, in fairness, the agents weren't lazy, and they were good, and they worked their socks off, and they really got the product around the place in that particular instance. But it is, they would be the laggards into it. You're absolutely right. And sometimes they're probably coming to it. We would see they're coming to it because the agency or the manufacturer has insisted on them using their system. So they've said, you need to go online and we're going to put you online. And it's the manufacturer who's putting the local agents online. They're saying, you need to go online. This is how it is. And you're going to pay a fee for this particular platform. And that's it. And you can't have the agency for this particular country anymore. But I don't know whether those kind of agencies are as common anymore.
They would typically have to now be agencies for multiple brands, and therefore they have to have their own e-commerce experience because they need to be able to bring multiple products and multiple categories of products online at the same time. And in many cases, I'm seeing that also some of those wholesalers, some of those distributors are starting to look at creating their own wholesale marketplace where they actually don't even have to hold inventory of all the products that they sell, that they're creating a verticalized marketplace that allows their sellers to come in and list their products on their website. And they become the nexus for the whole thing. Okay, maybe of all the products available on that website, they actually hold stock of and direct sell and are the merchant of record for 20% of the inventory, but the other 80%, they just clip the ticket on and someone else has to worry about the product. Somebody else has to worry about the images. Somebody else has to worry about the pricing. Somebody else has to worry about the inventory. Somebody else has to worry about the logistics. And all they have to do is to be the epicenter of where the customer goes to buy those types of products. So, man, there has been, after many years of what I call stagnation in the B2B space from an e-commerce perspective, where, you know, historically in the B2B space, e-commerce was pretty much one of two things. It was EDI or it was punch out. There was not a lot of self-service e-commerce as you and I know it today. But I tell you, that era of being a laggard is absolutely rapidly coming to an end in my experience. And more, I work almost exclusively with B2B brands now. And I tell you, the demand has never been higher. I've never seen it be such a rapid growth blue ocean space as I am now. And the number of inquiries that I'm getting from brands going, we realize we have got to get our ish together. Otherwise, we're going to be put out of business by somebody else who's a competitor. And oftentimes, it is literally a new competitor coming into the market who is an e-commerce pure play competitor that has forced their hand. A new competitor has come into the market. They're an e-commerce pure play. That's how they started out. That's how they're engaging with their customers. And they're going, wow, we're an established player and we don't offer e-commerce. And they're eating our lunch from a digital perspective for all the customers that want to buy exclusively eat from an e-commerce perspective. So they're having their feet held to the fire by the buyers more than anything else. And so I've seen rapid movement, particularly since COVID.
Yeah. To give you a case in point, like we have customers, quite a few customers in the catering, the B2B catering business. And we have seen where they have crossed over into other lines of product because they realize that their customers actually just want to get everything in the one place. So they've started broadening out what their actual offering is. And we're seeing it where they're just broadening out their offering. So if there's a guy supplying, for argument's sake, wines into a restaurant, they're now doing wines, but now they're deciding, actually, do you know what? I'm also going to start providing glasses and cutlery and plates and dishes. And they start going out and broadening what they're actually offering, because they suddenly realized when this guy comes onto my website to do his weekly or his daily order, I could make life an awful lot easier for this guy. And as you say, it's leading into that marketplace thing. I can make this guy's life an awful lot easier by just actually offering a whole wedge of stuff. And he actually will just buy it off, he or she will buy it off me for the pure convenience of it, because that's what it's about. In the end of the day, you and I only have 24 hours in the day. Bill Gates doesn't have any more hours in the day. And a child born 10 minutes ago doesn't have any more hours in the day. We all only have 24 hours in the day. And it's how efficiently you use that time. And that's the key. That really is the key. And if you're running your own business and you've got to run in and out of 10 different websites to buy something and it takes you 1.5 hours to do it, or you can get that job done within 10 minutes, the cost factor, unless it's absolutely prohibitive, you're going to suck up the cost factor on it. And it is, that's where B2B tends to sometimes get a better margin on the product, because they're actually adding into the convenience of it. That the guy coming in to buy the wines is now coming in to buy glasses. He's now coming in to buy a bit of cutlery. He's now coming in to buy spirits. I used to just supply wine. Now I'm actually supplying spirits. Now I'm doing
mixes. And beer.
Now I'm doing water. Now I'm doing beer. And now I'm going, oh yeah, and this guy, so he's a wine bar. Oh yeah. So now I'm going to start offering some deli stuff because he's selling tapas. And I'm starting to branch out into, okay, I'll start doing some deli or some non-perishable foodstuffs, snacks and all this kind of stuff. And next thing, there's a whole range of product that they would never have got into had they just got the agency for whatever it is, wine. And that was just what they sold. And that was it. And they sold nothing else. So it does. It is allowing these guys to expand their markets. And their enemy is that everybody cops on to what they've been at. And they want to keep it as the best kept secret, because it's not public facing most of the time, because they don't want to show their prices to the public. And it's a whole different approach to than retail e-commerce. But yeah, as you say, we're at the start of it. It's like that time in the early aughties when you used to be able to buy your Google advertising for 5 cents a click and 10 cents a click. And you were able to, whereas now it's $5 a click, it's $10 a click. And at that stage, when we were on 5 cents a click, and we were looking at guys, I think insurance companies were paying $5 and $6 a click in the early aughties. And we thought this was absolutely nuts, paying $5 or $6 a click. And now we look at it and it's at insane levels. And yet and all, that's something that B2B really don't need to dabble in. That cost of acquisition, that customer acquisition, it's all sorted for them already heading into it. So it's, yeah, for me, I would go to clients and I would go, when was the last time somebody walked into you with such a good opportunity? And I can't understand sometimes why they would go, we're not ready for it yet, or I will think about it or something. Because I think if I was running those kind of businesses and I was presented with the opportunity, I'd be taking the guy's arm off. He wouldn't be getting out the door quickly.
I'd be like, how fast can we get live? As opposed to how much is it going to cost me? Yeah. How quick can we do this thing, right? How quick can we execute on this? Now, Sean, as we come to the end of our time together, and I super appreciate all of your wisdom, your experience, and sharing it with me and my audience today. It's been a fantastic conversation. I like to turn the microphone over to my guest. I like to flip the script. I'd like to let them ask me one question, any question they like, be personal or professional. So Sean Owens from Granite Digital, what is your question for me today?
Yes. So my question for you today is, we see payments. Where do you see the future of payments? Because we've got this issue with, we've got credit cards and they're monopolized really by MasterCard and Visa at the moment. Monopoly is going to have to break. Do you have any kind of insight into where in the markets where you operate in? Have you seen something different happening within these markets for online payments?
Yeah, I'm seeing this change and being pressured by technology like balance payments, where they can facilitate H as if it was a credit card payment without needing to go through this heavy documented process and manually request an ACH payment and manually confirm an ACH payment. I think that balance and other technologies like theirs are rapidly changing the game for B2B payments. And it's not now, okay, we're going to run 30-day credit or 60-day credit or 90-day credit, and then we're going to make a wire transfer payment. It's that used to be the only way, or if it was in country, then it was a direct bank-to-bank payment that was initiated by the buyer. And they would take their statement for 30 days and they would pay that whole in a lump sum, and then they would allocate it to the 15 invoices on the statement or whatever it was. I think we're going to get to a place, and this is probably a perfect opportunity for crypto. I think that after the blow up of FTX but set back the adoption of crypto probably by a decade, just that whole shenanigans and that whole grift. And unfortunately, I think that gave the opportunity for national central banks to propose their CBDCs. And I think that is where the governments of the world and the central banks of the world are trying to push us all. They're trying to push us to CBDCs. And I see massive downsides for privacy, the ability to program the money at the government and federal level. That is a terrifying prospect. So I hope that CBDCs are roundly rejected by citizens around the world, and that independent cryptocurrencies that are regulated as any other asset would be, as any other digital asset would be. I think that crypto absolutely needs some level of regulation to be viable as a medium of exchange like anything else. But I think that this is actually a perfect opportunity for cryptocurrency. I think that instant transfers via cryptocurrency, because I've bought and sold cryptocurrencies before via exchanges. And the reality is that it happens in literally seconds. And we already have systems and platforms like Remitly and Wise that I use as an international digital nomad. I'm already using Wise, and I will move money into Wise. I'll do a direct bank-to-bank transfer from, say, for example, a bank account in New Zealand into Wise. And then Wise, once the money hits Wise, I can convert it into any currency within my Wise account that I like at the time, or I can set up a predefined trigger of when I want to convert that money to another currency based on a specific exchange rate. And then it's just sitting there in multiple currencies. And then I can make a direct, for example, Wise to Mexican bank account transfer, and it's instantaneous from Wise. It happens when it's not even cryptocurrency, but they have a direct rails between Wise and my local bank here in Mexico. And that happens literally within less than 1 minute. If I make a transfer from Wise in pesos, it's already converted into pesos by Wise, and then it can end up in my Mexican bank account within minutes. And I think that there are slowly emerging equivalent platforms for the B2B world. They're not ubiquitous yet, and they're very country and currency specific at the moment. But there's just no way that the current status quo in B2B payments can last. It's just, as you say, it is way too expensive. It is way too complex. It is way too time consuming. I just don't see the status quo lasting beyond the next couple of years, because the opportunity here for fintech to grease the wheels of B2B payments, that opportunity is just way too massive for someone not to do something about it.
Yeah, and it's curious you'd say that, Jason, because I would be thinking along the same as yourself. And then I look at fintech and I just go, it's just moving so slowly in some sectors. It's just, it's almost stagnant. I built my first online shop in 1999. Like, it was built with PayPal buttons. It hasn't changed a whole lot since. It's still a home page. It's still a category listing page. It's still a product detail page with a buy now button on it. It has not changed a whole lot in some ways. And in other ways, it has changed. But the whole fintech thing, even at that stage, was so slow, so cumbersome.
Expensive.
And it still is. And it's expensive. And it's just this whole thing of charging, as I was saying, it's exactly the same amount of CPU power to do the security on a €2 as a €200. Or a €2,000. I do not understand how people, or how a competitor hasn't entered the market and said, that's enough of that. We're now going for fixed fees on bands, and that's it. And that's the way we're going to operate. But you're absolutely right. Like on stuff like international transactions, as the prices of things fluctuate so quickly and so rapidly, this has to come into play, because the margins are going to get so thin that actually waiting 2 or 3 days for a bank transfer, or waiting 2 or 3 days for your money, inflation could have taken your margin away in you. Like
even just the exchange rate movements, which can fluctuate wildly.
Well, the exchange rate with inflation, with something else, all added together could absolutely just wipe you out, especially if you're, say, on an 8% margin or a 6% margin. Those kind of margins are lost at high speed very fast. And that, to me, would be the biggest. I see that as the biggest issue. It's not actually business owners getting their data in and descriptions of products and images of products and linking in with EDI and all that kind of stuff. It's not that. It's actually payments. And isn't it interesting that in 2024, we're still talking about payments that are taking days. And it's just, and as opposed to other payments that literally happen instantaneously. And it's just, yeah, you just wonder how long can this hold out for? Yeah, it is interesting.
Even Stripe holds your money as a business. Even as a business selling services, I've got a Stripe account to facilitate that. They will hold my funds that my customers have paid via business credit card. They will hold those funds for a minimum of 3 days before they even make a payout. And of course, they make interest on that float that they have at any given point in time, yeah. Right? And so this is just, it's a legacy situation that until they are forced to change, they won't. Why would they give away margin? Why would they give away interest? Why would they give away that float amount, that cash cushion that they have, if they don't have to? And that's the reality. So until a challenger comes along that makes this easy and really starts to eat their lunch, they won't make a change. Listen, Sean, I have significantly enjoyed our conversation. I've learned a ton. I really appreciate it. You've been in the game for a very long time. I super appreciate it. I will put the links to your LinkedIn profile and to your business inside the show notes. But how do you typically, if somebody wants to get a hold of you and have a conversation about this whole B2B e-commerce thing, particularly in UK, Europe, Ireland, how are they best to get a hold of you?
They can catch me on my email address, which is just sean.owens@granite.ie, or they can catch me on our website, which is willows-consulting.com, is our website that specializes in the B2B end of e-commerce. So I'd be quite happy to have a chat with anybody. And if anybody wants to link up, have a demo of Sage 50 linked into e-commerce within an hour, we have another website called 50ecom.com, and you can just sign up for the demo there, and I'd quite happily bring anybody who wants to be brought through it.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.